could only be conjecture and purely speculative, Boyle said later. Whether additional assistance would have been of any material help in rescuing her from the car had not been pursued either, because such failure, even when shown, does not constitute criminal conduct. This was an astonishing ruling. In view of the omission to act liability, Kennedy's attorneys had feared as a basis for a possible manslaughter charge. Either Boyle didn't know the Supreme Court decision on the Walansky case, one colleague observed later, or he didn't understand how it applied to the Kennedy accident. John Farrar disputed Boyle's contention there was no evidence air had remained in the car after it was submerged. Two of us in the fire department saw air emanating, but were not allowed to testify on that aspect. Next on the stand, Farrar testified he had found the victim's head cocked back, face pressed into the footwell, hand holding herself in a position such as she could avail herself of the last remaining air in the car. Fernandez cut Farrar short. "You don't know what was done," he said. Farrar was to describe exactly what you saw, and not speculate on whether professional rescue efforts, if promptly made at the time of the accident, would have saved Mary Jo Kopechne's life, or to deliver himself of the opinion she suffocated in her own air void. She didn't drown. Boyle suggested a description of the car's length and weight would be helpful in making his report. After receiving specifications from a local Oldsmobile dealer, Richard McCarran dictated an affidavit to Donegan at the house on School Street. In concluding the inquest, Boyle had gone over the evidence to make sure he had not omitted anything that might be available, and then find out there was something I didn't obtain. But Boyle's self-congratulation was vainglorious. The inquest had been conducted in a haphazard manner. Gaping contradictions in testimony allowed to go unchallenged during the incomplete questioning of witnesses, called in no particular order or sequence. No attempt had been made to confront one witness's testimony with another's with regard to continuity and consistency. Skeptical as Boyle was about the testimony of the Boiler Room girls, he had confined himself to making ironic remarks about it from the bench. Other relevant witnesses had not been called to testify, including Sylvia Malm and her daughter, reading under an open window facing Dyke Bridge, sometime between 11:15 and 11:45 p.m. on the night of the accident. Denise did not bother to call other Dyke Road residents who left lights on in their houses to challenge the senator's testimony there were absolutely no lights in that area that I noticed. Foster Silva was not called to testify about the yelling, music, and general sounds of hell-raising at the Lawrence Cottage that had continued to 1:30 a.m., a reported variance with the duration and character of the party as described by inquest witnesses. Denise had kept Flynn's investigation of license plates off the record, and Stan Moore and three registry inspectors off the witness stand, testimony that, had it been given, would have tended to discredit Kennedy's version of the accident. Fernandez defended the inept character of the inquest. "You've got to remember this wasn't a trial. It was an informational process, hence no cross-examination," he said. "Boyle decided what got on the record and what didn't. Some purely hearsay evidence, like Kennedy's beer with Jack Driscoll, was allowed. Other hearsay evidence was not. We were hidebound by that," Fernandez said. "Under Boyle's guidelines, you couldn't really question testimony. It was merely received." Denise was satisfied. "We put on the record all the witnesses that were available," he told reporters outside the courthouse. "When we started, we had nothing. Now we have a hell of a lot more." Denise declined to speculate on the possibility of criminal charges against Ted Kennedy coming out of the inquest. He could make no decision about prosecution before Boyle filed his inquest report. But it was unlikely the grand jury would take action in the case. Denise said, "Traditionally, the grand jury does not function without the advice of the district attorney. Should Boyle's report find negligence on the part of Senator Kennedy had contributed to Mary Jo Kopechne's death, Denise would have no choice but to seek an indictment for manslaughter if Boyle didn't make the complaint for him. Word of the inquest's end was telephoned by Jack Miller to Stephen Smith, reported to be in conference with Senator Kennedy at the compound in Hyannisport. Kennedy left Cape Cod immediately. "I'm glad it's over," he told reporters at Washington National Airport, a short distance from the lobby where Bernie Flynn had disclosed inquest evidence to Jack Miller. "I answered the questions to the best of my ability," Kennedy said. "I am hopeful now of getting back to the business of the Senate." But the drama's denouement was yet to come. Judge Boyle asked to be relieved of court duties in order to devote himself to reviewing 763 pages of inquest testimony. On February 18th, a tightly sealed cardboard box containing the inquest transcript and report was carried from Edgartown to the clerk of Suffolk County Superior Court for Criminal Business in Boston, to be locked in an office safe. The documents would be available to Denise, Attorney General Robert Quinn, and counsel for any person named in the report as having been responsible for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Lawyers for other witnesses would be allowed to check their client's testimony for accuracy and submit corrections. Any person seeking to examine the transcript and report had to set forth in writing the basis for his claim of access. Edward Hanafy's petition requesting review of Senator Kennedy's testimony was promptly granted. A week later, Hanafy was allowed to examine the inquest report. A step-by-step recapitulation of the known facts of the case based upon testimony that contained inconsistencies and contradictions too numerous for Boyle to attempt to enumerate. The report placed the time of the accident between 11:30 p.m. on July 18th and 1 o'clock a.m. on July 19th, straddling both Kennedy and Look's schedules of the accident. Under the statute, Boyle had to report the name of any person whose unlawful act or negligence appeared to have contributed to Mary Jo Kopechne's death. Based upon inquest evidence, Boyle inferred that Kennedy and Kopechne did not intend to drive to the ferry slip, and his turn onto Dyke Road had been intentional. Dyke Bridge constituted a traffic hazard, particularly at night, and must be approached with extreme caution, Boyle said. A car of even 20 miles per hour, as Kennedy testified to operating a car as large as his Oldsmobile, would be at least negligent and possibly reckless. If Kennedy knew of the hazard that lay ahead of him on Dyke Road, his operation of the car constituted criminal conduct. Since Kennedy was driven over Dyke Bridge twice on July 18th, Boyle believed it was probable he knew of the hazard. But for some reason not apparent from his testimony, he failed to exercise due care as he approached the bridge. Boyle therefore found, "There is probable cause to believe that Edward M. Kennedy operated his motor vehicle negligently, and that such operation appears to have contributed to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne." Having found probable cause of negligent motor vehicle operation, Boyle failed to exercise the statutory requirement to issue process for the arrest of the person charged in the report with the commission of a crime. By citing the law requiring him to issue a warrant if evidence indicated guilt, and not doing so, Boyle was admitting his action was unlawful. But whether Boyle made the charge officially or not, the damage was done. Not only had he impugned fault to Kennedy's driving, but suggested he and others had lied at the inquest, consolidating all public doubts and suspicions about the case in one damning and devastating conclusion. Kennedy's lawyers were stunned. "We, of course, read the report in advance," McCarran recalled. "If Boyle thought Senator Kennedy was guilty of a crime, we thought he should have bound the case over to the Superior Court." But McCarran was glad Boyle hadn't. The judge had left a narrow loophole, perhaps large enough for Senator Kennedy to slip through. In guiding himself with regard to the proof required of the commission of an unlawful act, Boyle had applied the standard of probable guilt in grand jury hearings to bring an indictment. Having fulfilled that portion of the statutory commandment pointing to Kennedy's criminal negligence, Boyle was virtually inviting Denise to do something about it. Angered that the district attorney had required him to hold an inquest, instead of taking on responsibility for conducting an investigation himself, Boyle was bouncing the case back where he thought it belonged. If anyone was going to bring charges against Ted Kennedy, it was going to be Denise. On vacation in Portugal, Denise told Diario Popular The Chappaquiddick case had not been shelved. "The judge is preparing his report," he said. "When I get back, the report will be presented to me and will be studied in detail. Two things can happen. Either the process is reopened and a new investigation is carried out, or it is closed." Interviewed by a television talk show host, puzzled that a small city district attorney had authority to prosecute so important a political personage as Senator Edward Kennedy, something unheard of under the dictatorship of Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, Denise explained, "Our system is a rule of law, not a rule of men." Denise was going to get the chance to prove his words when he was ushered into Suffolk County Courthouse and shown Boyle's report. "Son of a bitch," Denise muttered, stormed out of the building, and refused to talk to reporters. In Denise's view, if Boyle thought Senator Kennedy was probably guilty of a crime, he had a moral duty to seek a complaint. Boyle had gone as far as he could go, but fell short of an indictment, Fernandez explained. He could have, in his discretion, brought charges, but he didn't. What he said, in effect, was, "Yes, there's some evidence of negligence here, but not enough to bring a charge." How much negligence was required to become legally criminal was a line very difficult to draw, Fernandez said. Clearly, Denise was not prepared to draw that line. His experience in investigating the case had been sobering. Prodded by the press to enter the case, once he did so, he had been subjected to ridicule and accusations of seeking to advance his own career. In seeking answers to the mysteries of the accident, he had encountered a judicial stone wall, the courts doing everything to favor Kennedy's cause. Fed up with being the scapegoat of the inquiry, Denise complained, "Others in appropriate power avoided everything." Denise had run out of options. There was no alternative now except to prosecute Ted Kennedy on the basis of the inquest evidence, as Boyle was challenging him to. Or fail to bring charges and be accused of dereliction of duty, and God knows what else when the inquest documents were published. With Boyle's report a ticking time bomb ready to explode when it was made public, Denise made no decision at all. But he was clearly unwilling to prosecute the case, Jimmy Smith recognized. Denise didn't want to go down as the guy who put the bullet in Teddy Kennedy. He wanted to save him. Chapter 53. That inquest documents had not been made public immediately suggested to grand jury foreman Leslie Leland that the report had been unfavorable to Senator Kennedy. Leland conferred informally with members of the grand jury. Questions about Kennedy's explanation of the accident remained. Jurors suspected the senator had devoted a considerable portion of his 9-hour delay to report the accident to grope for some way of escaping involvement. "Most of us felt Kennedy was morally responsible for the death of that girl," one juror said. "We talked about bringing in Kennedy and some of the girls present at the cookout." On March 17th, at his drugstore in Vineyard Haven, Leland composed a letter to Chief Justice Joseph Touro of the Superior Court, asking the grand jury be called out of recess to consider the Kennedy accident. The grand jury had a duty and a responsibility to come up with answers that have been long overdue and try to close the case once and for all, Leland said. It was the feeling of most Edgartown residents that the death of Mary Jo Kopechne should have been disposed of a long time ago. "Everyone feels that a great injustice has been done to the democratic process, that there's been a whitewash, a cover-up, and that things have been swept under the rug. A great deal of time has passed since the girl died, and it's time the public found out what happened." The main purpose of Leland's request was to examine the inquest transcript and report, he said, "We want to see what's there and what isn't there." Leland followed proper procedure by directing his letter to the court through the district attorney's office. Reluctant to go forward himself, Denise now faced the prospect of the grand jury taking the case away from him and deciding it for themselves. "Leland wanted to keep it an Edgartown case. That's the island mentality," Jimmy Smith said. "They wanted Ted Kennedy on a spear, and they weren't going to let anybody take him off. And this was on an island where they didn't have anybody smart enough in all 5 police departments to prosecute a case in the district court." Denise received an advisory opinion on March 24th from Justice Toro that he could reconvene the grand jury into special session at any time. Leland was very pleased. His request for authorization to conduct an investigation into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne had been granted. Denise had been asked to seek the court's permission to reopen the case, but the district attorney would play only a minor role as a counsel to the grand jury. Leland intended to conduct the investigation himself. Leland hoped the inquest report would be made available. If it wasn't, the grand jury could subpoena all those who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick and commence their own investigation from scratch. "We want to finalize this matter once and for all as far as Dukes County is concerned," Leland said. "It's been my attitude since the accident that the public is entitled to know what happened, instead of this air of secrecy that has floated over the case." That Denise had not taken the initiative in seeking further prosecution had indicated to defense lawyer Dick McCarran that no further charges against Senator Kennedy were justified. McCarran was disturbed by rumors that Leland had been getting advice on how to proceed with the case from one particularly aggressive television reporter. Other grand jurors were being interviewed by the press. A violation of common law, McCarran complained to Denise. They could be getting evidence to use in their deliberations. There wasn't anything McCarran could do to head off the new investigation, but procure a grand jury list and commence a rundown on members. The grand jury was beyond the reach of hearings on ground rules or appeals to a higher court. Senator Kennedy faced the most serious liability from the accident since Denise had asked for an inquest. What his attorneys feared was an indictment for manslaughter emanating from the grand jury when it assembled at 10 a.m. on April 6th at Edgartown Courthouse, 3 months after the inquest. But judicial good fortune continued to favor Ted Kennedy. Assigned by Chief Justice Toro as custodian of impounded inquest documents was Judge Wilfred Packey. A portly man with a stentorian voice and a reputation for indulging his disagreeable temper from the bench, Packey was a curious choice. A former member of the Democratic State Committee, rewarded with a judgeship for running the successful campaign of Governor Paul Deaver, Packey was, of all jurists assigned to hear aspects of the Chappaquiddick case, the one person you could call a Kennedy file, a colleague on the bench remarked. In addition, Packey was a former client of Edward Hanafy. Note, in 1961, Packey sentenced two bookies to 10 years in jail, then ordered their release because he considered his sentence too harsh. Hanafy had represented Packey before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, which had upheld Packey's honor and integrity. Citing judicial ethics, Toro declined to say whether Packey should have disqualified himself from presiding at the special session of Superior Court to receive any indictments the grand jury might hand down. At the opening of the court session, a priest's invocation called upon grand jurors to be guided by mercy, meekness, and compassion in their deliberations, qualities conspicuously lacking in Packey's instructions. For over an hour, Packey harangued the jurors against being too zealous, stressing the need for an unbiased investigation. "You must bear in mind that you will not be trying this case. Your function is to indict those people who you believe committed a crime. You decide an indictment strictly on the evidence that is submitted to you." Jurors could consider only what was called to their attention by the court, the district attorney, or what individual members know personally about the case. More importantly, Packey didn't think it was legal for the jurors to see inquest documents and refused to permit them to examine the transcript and report unless the Supreme Court revised its decision for the documents to remain impounded until no possibility of further legal action was contemplated. A construction of the new inquest guidelines set by the court on Kennedy's appeal that was way off base, in Assistant District Attorney Peter Gay's opinion. The reason to impound inquest records was to avoid pretrial publicity. That wouldn't be reason to keep it from a grand jury, because their deliberations are always secret. The court impounded these things to keep them out of the hands of the public. Even when he was arguing before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Edward Hanafy had considered the inquest procedure accusatory because a report could lead to a grand jury proceeding and further criminal process. The Supreme Court had demanded a closed hearing to avoid premature publicity about an investigation preceding an indictment being sought or returned against a potential defendant, indicating the legitimate expectation of grand jury access to inquest documents. The grand jury could have appealed to the Supreme Court for the release of inquest documents to them, or started their own investigation. But they were led to believe they couldn't subpoena Senator Kennedy or any witness who had testified at the inquest, a critical error in their interpretation of Packey's instructions. Denise did nothing to disabuse them of that mistaken notion. Jurors could only summon witnesses who had new information, he said. One juror suggested, "Well, you were at the inquest. We can call you as witness to what was said." Denise had no evidence to present, he said. "We don't really believe he did it on purpose, do we? We know that a murder wasn't committed. It was just an unfortunate accident." "We definitely discussed involuntary manslaughter with the grand jury," Fernandez recalled. "We tried to explain what was required to make that charge. The lack of eyewitnesses to the accident made prosecution of any serious charges against Senator Kennedy difficult." Denise derided talk of a traffic complaint being brought against the senator as Mickey Mouse stuff. "He just kept saying there wasn't much sense going into it," Leland said, "that we would get no significant charges out of it." By law, Denise was required to present evidence and avoid expressing an opinion as to whether an indictment should be handed down. But Denise deliberately steered the grand jury away from the pursuit of charges against Senator Kennedy, suggesting there was nothing in the inquest record upon which to base an indictment. Despite having read the report himself, Denise led jurors to believe Boyle had found no wrongdoing. Leland went personally to the judge's chambers to plead again for a copy of the inquest documents. Packey refused. With the transcript and report impounded, and forbidden to call key witnesses who had appeared at the inquest, the grand jury's investigation was narrowed to a focus of a handful of secondary witnesses and what they knew personally about the case. As its first witness, the jury called Stephen Gentle, owner of the Katama Air Park. Gentle denied rumors a plane had left his airfield during the early hours of July 19th. Mrs. Nina Trott, desk clerk at the Shiretown Inn, had so little to offer as evidence that she testified for only 5 minutes. Resuming the next morning, the jurors heard from Edgartown resident Benjamin Hall, who told them he had overheard an argument during the early hours of Saturday, July 19th, between Russell Peachy and a person who sounded intoxicated, but whom he couldn't identify. Having sent someone from his office to mingle with reporters to find out who the grand jury was calling to testify, McCarran learned, to his delight, these witnesses didn't know anything about the case. Though reluctant to stop there, the grand jury had no choice. "It was very discouraging," one juror said. "We had no cooperation, so we felt we might as well go home." At 10:55 a.m., the grand jury filed into the courtroom. Leland announced he had no presentments to make. Packey excused the jurors from further deliberations, reminding them of their pledge of secrecy. "I don't mean for a day. I mean forever. It was made quite clear and emphatic that I can't talk to anyone," a dejected Leland told reporters, leaving the courthouse. Leland was returning to his drugstore. "Because it's necessary to make a living and support my family." Denise was hardly able to contain his relief. "At the end of this particular investigation into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne," he said, "the case is closed." Denise intended to file appropriate certificates, notifying the Superior Court no criminal prosecution of Senator Kennedy was contemplated, clearing the way for the release of inquest documents. The grand jury was without purpose, Denise said later. "They were on a wild goose chase. I challenged them to come up with more evidence, more witnesses, but they couldn't produce anything." If Denise was seeking to shift blame for the lack of prosecution in the case, he admitted later, "There's no question in my mind the grand jury would have indicted Ted Kennedy for involuntary manslaughter if I had given them the case." That Denise had chosen not to do so was an exercise of prosecutorial privilege, Armand Fernandez said later. The investigative portion of the case had been more or less accomplished by the inquest, fulfilling the need to interrogate witnesses. Their testimony did not indicate a trial would lead to a successful prosecution. There was no point in pursuing an indictment when you know you don't have a winnable case. That isn't ethical. Actually, Denise did the right thing, although he knew he would be criticized for it. To indict Ted Kennedy for manslaughter, knowing you couldn't prove the case in court, would definitely have been publicity-seeking, Fernandez said, and Denise didn't stoop to doing that. Packy's refusal to allow access to the inquest documents had been crucial in keeping the case out of the grand jury's hands, Fernandez said. If our office had appealed to the court for an advisory opinion, I think it's fair to say the odds were 1,000 to 1 Packy would have been overruled. Gargan agreed the ruling had been a questionable call. Packy was a judge of the old school, he said. He'll do you a favor and do it publicly, and be damned. Packy refused to discuss the case, telling reporters, "To hell with you. I don't have to talk to you." McCarran flashed word to Angelique Boutsellis, Senator Kennedy's secretary in Washington, of the termination of the grand jury proceedings. Senator Kennedy was happy with the findings of the grand jury. One juror bristled, "There were no findings. We weren't allowed to make any." The senator was anxious for the inquest transcript to be released, to eliminate any suspicion in the case. But the report was bound to have a devastating effect on his career. There was, however, a trade-off worth the price. According to the Supreme Court's ruling, release of inquest documents would forever prevent Ted Kennedy from being prosecuted on any charges dealing with the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Whether Judge Boyle had found him probably guilty of manslaughter and suggested he'd lied at the inquest didn't matter. Legally, Kennedy couldn't be touched. But release of inquest documents was blocked by court stenographer Sidney Lipman on April 8th. Claiming valuable property rights, Lipman filed suit to prevent the distribution by the Superior Court of inquest documents for the $75 cost of their reproduction, as opposed to $820.20 at Lipman's professional rates. Denise knew of no other case in which an official stenographer had been denied the right to sell copies of a transcript. Lipman was relying on payment from the news media for his services. Dukes County could not afford to pay him for some time. On April 23rd, Edward Hanafy filed a petition on behalf of Senator Kennedy, asking the Supreme Judicial Court to release the documents to ensure order and decorum in the public examination. No person had private property interests or the exclusive right to make copies of court documents, the court ruled only hours later, ordering the transcript and report made public. On April 29th, more than 50 reporters crowded into Suffolk County Superior Court in Boston for the release of the bulky documents. What reporters read staggered them, detonating another explosion of controversy about the case. The effort to manage inquest testimony had backfired. That Senator Kennedy had not spoken the truth about the accident was the only finding a jurist of integrity could make, the New Bedford Standard Times charged. That Judge Boyle had not ordered further legal process after finding Kennedy had contributed to Mary Jo Kopechne's death would lead many to conclude, where justice in Massachusetts is concerned, there is one door for John Doe and another for Senator Kennedy. Grand jury foreman Leland was trying to digest what I've heard about the inquest documents. He still had not had a chance to read them. Denise had sat through the grand jury session knowing what was in the transcript and report, without letting us know, he said. Things might have been different if the grand jury had seen the documents, but we couldn't get our hands on it. There was still a possibility to reconvene the grand jury, which remained impaneled until May 11th, Leland said. But I'll have to wait until I read the report. A bigger bunch of dumbbells you'd never hope to find. I most certainly include myself, Grand Juror Teresa Moore observed. We were dupes and boobs, and let ourselves be manipulated. Nobody ever briefed us properly about what we could do. We were a powerful body made impotent by Mr. Denise. Arena was a little bit surprised by Boyle's report. In his opinion, there were contributory factors to negligence. The bridge is a hazard. Arena hadn't had enough evidence to go forward for a negligence complaint. I don't care what Boyle said. He has only to look for probable causes, but the district attorney has to determine whether a complaint will hold up in court. If Boyle is saying Kennedy did something wrong, I'd be interested to see what the indictment says. Because if they could prove something else, it was all right by me. Release of inquest documents marked Judge Boyle's last day on the Edgartown District Court, leaving in the wake of his retirement a furor, not a resolution. Chappaquiddick had ended as it began. In mystery, with many questions unanswered both by Senator Kennedy and by authorities, the Standard Times said. A classic example of how the ends of justice can be frustrated. The case may be closed in the eyes of the law, but it leaves Senator Kennedy under a cloud, the Boston Record-American said. And though that may diminish in time, it will cast a shadow on his future. In a statement issued from his office on the day inquest documents were made public, Senator Kennedy announced, "The facts of this incident are now fully public, and eventual judgment and understanding rests where it belongs. For myself, I plan no further statement on this tragic matter. Both our families have suffered enough from public utterances and speculations." In Kennedy's personal view, "The inferences and ultimate findings for the judge's report are not justified, and I reject them." Attorney General Robert Quinn confirmed, "No criminal action is likely against Senator Kennedy. The legal aspects are over," he said. "Politically, it remains to be seen." Chapter 54. Politically, it was disastrous. Just when Kennedy appeared to be re-emerging as a possible presidential candidate. According to opinion polls, public opinion nationwide turned decisively against the senator after the publication of the inquest documents, with more people believing he had concealed what happened at Chappaquiddick. The heart of Kennedy's problems stemmed from a widespread belief that his own testimony at the inquest was not accurate or truthful. Strolling Boston's public garden with William Honan of the New York Times several days after release of the inquest transcript, Kennedy refused to respond to doubts being expressed about the credibility of his inquest testimony. "Every time I say something, for example, that I swam the channel, 15 people turn up who said they were in a boat about that time and they didn't see me swimming. So then I have to explain that," Kennedy said. "Everything just adds. There doesn't seem to be any way to end it." Reminded he had wanted to reveal the full story of the accident, but considered it unwise to do so because of the rumor-filled atmosphere and pending legal proceedings, Kennedy reneged on his promised press conference to respond to questions left unanswered by the inquest. "That was the last summer, before the inquest," he said. "It's all in the transcript now, so I don't have anything more to say." That the Kopechnys might file a civil damage suit on the basis of Boyle's finding of criminal negligence in the accident was always a possibility, Kennedy said. But he had received no indication they were contemplating such action. "The inquest transcript was the most difficult and disturbing reading we've ever done," Gwen Kopechny said. "We finally realized how unfortunate it was we hadn't been allowed to attend the inquest and hear the witnesses firsthand, because we found in the testimony so many inconsistencies and contradictions. The questioning of witnesses was so incomplete and superficial. It was all left hanging. Nobody seemed to be following the case properly. The district attorney was falling apart, going from question to question. He'd get an answer but didn't follow through. There There were so many questions I could have asked he never thought of asking. The testimony of the young women had been partially unsatisfactory. It all sounds alike. It's too pat. I think Judge Boyle might have thought it was rehearsed. From reading the transcript, I began to disbelieve in the legal process, Joseph Kopechne said. To me, it was unbelievable. George Killen could only agree. Stung by accusations that those charged with official responsibility in investing the case, fairly and impartially, had instead shown a lack of vigor and diligence. For Denise not to have sought an indictment from the grand jury was an embarrassment to his office. Too good a cop not to recognize a prosecutable case when he saw one, Killen knew court procedures backwards. There was enough evidence for reasonable inferences to be made from the facts, Killen said. If Senator Kennedy was at the wheel of that car, and he drove down Dyke Road in a certain way, there's no question about his negligence. Not only had Denise kept evidence from the grand jury, but Killen only got to read the case after we couldn't do anything about it. A legal trick had prevented prosecution after the inquest testimony was made public. Killen never suspected his investigation into the accident had been betrayed by Bernie Flynn. Privately, Flynn blamed the collapse of the case on Edmund Denise. Boyle's report put the ball in his court, and Denise dropped it like a hot potato. Flynn agreed. The testimony at the inquest was all rehearsed. Everybody knew what they had to say to corroborate Ted Kennedy. That the senator had accepted the assistance Flynn had rendered to protect himself from criminal charges issuing from the inquest, Flynn regarded as characteristic of the man. Ted Kennedy cheated at Harvard, and he cheated at the inquest. Because the senator's Oldsmobile was a total loss, the insurance company had to pay on it, McCarran recalled, so they owned the car legally. Edward Hanafy purchased the automobile back from the insurance company to prevent it from falling into the hands of a promoter for display at a freak show as the Chappaquiddick Death Car. McCarran towed the vehicle from the state police barracks to the dock at Oak Bluffs. Jimmy Smith arranged for transportation by ferry to Woods Hole. A wrecker brought the automobile to Plymouth to be gutted for parts, then crushed into scrap. Jimmy Smith was also dealing with the residual consequences of the accident. Joe Grealish was pushing hard for the postmastership, making not-so-subtle references to the suppression of license information and other favors the registry had performed in the Kennedy accident case, Smith said. Smith had some bad news for Grealish. His son wasn't going to get the job. Grealish had some bad news for Senator Kennedy a month later. Following the long-postponed registry hearing into the accident held in Hyannis on May 18th. On the basis of the facts of the case presented, it would appear that Kennedy did not see the bridge in time and put on his brakes, losing steering ability and slid off the right side of the bridge. I believe there was operation too fast for existing conditions, Grealish reported. I do not find that the accident occurred without serious fault. On May 27th, Registrar McLaughlin informed Senator Kennedy, "Upon investigation and after a hearing, I am unable to find that the fatal accident in which a motor vehicle operated by you was involved was without serious fault on your part." Kennedy's license was revoked for an additional 6 months. Any driver aggrieved by the hearing's decision could appeal, but Kennedy didn't bother. On June 11th, Kennedy formally announced his candidacy for re-election. 4 days later, on June 15th, Kennedy was driving, in violation of his license revocation, the 35 miles from Boston to Haverhill in less than an hour, despite fairly heavy traffic, accompanied by author Lester David and campaign aide Paul Kirk. The senator never drove a car when Jack Crimmins was available, Goggin said, but Crimmins was helping him advance a campaign appearance. There was a problem at the cutoff on Route 93 getting where we wanted to go. Crimmins and Gargan were waiting by the side of the road when Kennedy drove up, got out of the car, and climbed into Crimmins' automobile. Kennedy was waiting for the start of a parade celebrating Haverhill's 100th anniversary as a city when a portable cannon was practice-fired close by. Doubled up, hands clutching his stomach, Kennedy fell against the car seat, his face drained of color. Moments later, he was smiling and jaunty, marching the 4-mile parade route, waving at crowds lining the curbside. "Good work, Senator," a bystander shouted when Kennedy passed. Two girls kissed him during a pause in the parade's route. The senator received a centennial hat and was proclaimed, "Kennedy, our next president." The senator disclaimed any intentions of seeking the nomination in 1972. He would remain in public life, as long as I felt that I could be effective in the United States Senate on the issues. Kennedy was running a shoe-leather campaign for re-election, widely heralded as a preliminary to seeking the Democratic presidential nomination. But Chappaquiddick changed all that, James Reston observed. And the paradox of it is that he is probably a more reliable man today than he was a year ago. Sadder, wiser, more disciplined, but rejected for the presidency in 1972 by his party and by himself. A different Ted Kennedy stumped New Bedford in July. Hair shaggy and graying, wearing a somber suit, more soft-spoken and reflective since the release of inquest documents. The Standard Times was endorsing Kennedy's re-election, even though the Chappaquiddick incident has left a sour taste in our mouth. To this day, Senator Kennedy has never fully answered all questions about his actions during the tragic episode. Kennedy himself acknowledged the incident was an issue in the election. "The voters need reassurance. They need to see me to be convinced that I'm reliable and mature," he said. "You can't counter the Chappaquiddick thing directly. The answer has to be implicit in what you are, what you stand for, and the way they see you." One place Ted Kennedy wasn't going to be seen was the Edgartown Regatta. He wasn't entered in the 1970 races. Dyke Bridge remained a popular tourist attraction, access to which was facilitated by a new on-time, with an expanded 3-car capacity. In vain did island residents brandish a new bumper sticker. "Chappie's our home. Leave us alone." Arena was anticipating, "At least one TV man will be here to cover the anniversary of the accident." The Kopechnys marked the occasion at their daughter's grave. A bouquet of red and white carnations was sent by Senator Kennedy. Rosemary Keough carried a basket of daisies to the cemetery. She said, "My friend Mary Jo just happened to be in the wrong car, at the wrong time, with the wrong people." The Kopechnys received a check for $140,923 from the General Accident Group of Philadelphia, which had carried $1 million accident policy on Senator Kennedy's car. Their lawyer, Joseph Flanagan, revealed the figure to end speculation about a settlement rumored to be as high as $500,000. The figure, proposed by a professional actuary of Mary Jo Kopechne's potential lifetime earnings, had been accepted without protest by Kennedy's insurance company, Flanagan said. Kennedy had paid nothing out of his own pocket. But both statements were false. The insurance company had refused to pay more than the $50,000 maximum allowed under Massachusetts law for accidental death the Kopechnys could recover if they were unable to prove their daughter had consciously suffered before she died. Informed the Kopechnys planned to sue, Senator Kennedy agreed to pay the $90,923 difference. Obviously, a financial settlement could never compensate the Kopechny family for the loss of their daughter, or for the tragedy of the accident, Kennedy said. But if there was to be one, I thought it should be fair. Flanagan also negotiated the sale of Gwen Kopechny's story to McCall's, written, she said, to put rest the ugly rumors that have been torturing us. Judge Boyle's conclusion that Senator Kennedy had lied when he said he and Mary Jo had been driving to the ferry leaves a bad taste in our mouths, and we absolutely reject it and any implications that flow from it. Her daughter, she insisted, had not been involved in a romance over the regatta weekend. Among her boyfriends, there was not one named Senator Edward Kennedy. Mrs. Kopechny was convinced the senator had done all he could to save Mary Jo by diving down to the car. "We also believe that the senator was in shock when he started back to the cottage after his unsuccessful rescue attempt. if his judgment hadn't been impaired, was certain that he would have tried to get immediate help at one of the houses along the way. Although the senator was obviously distraught, Joseph Gargan and Paul Markham had been in full possession of their senses. "Mr. Kopechne and I have been very disturbed by their actions. Why did they assume that Mary Jo was dead and then not seek help? Whoever knows when it's too late for rescue?" By not notifying authorities promptly, Gargan and Markham had invited all kinds of awful speculation. She said, "Many people will always think there was more to this tragedy than just an accident." But compensating the Kopechnes for the death of their daughter was only part of the cost of Chappaquiddick. Kennedy paid $32,000 to Paul Redmond and Dan Daly for their representation of 8 witnesses at the inquest. Other lawyers retained in the case submitted bills. Some of them were heavy hitters, one insider said. Stephen Smith was surprised to learn that Joseph Donahue was not charging for his services. Out of friendship and regard for Gargan, Donahue said, "There will be no fee." Chappaquiddick also exacted a price in the election. Over 100,000 blank votes, reducing Kennedy's percentage of victory to 58%, far short of his record 1964 plurality. But Kennedy was sufficiently buoyed by his victory to reassert claims of national leadership in a victory speech televised from his heavily guarded headquarters in Boston. "I look forward to being a voice for peace in the U.S. Senate, a voice of reconciliation that appeals to the best within people," Kennedy said. "I return to the Senate to give voice to the powerless groups that exist within our society." On November 27th, Kennedy went to Plymouth to undergo a full driver's license examination. He used a Cadillac to take and pass his driver's test and received his license. For all practical purposes, the consequences of Chappaquiddick were over. Edmund Denise had been confident he would be reelected to a 4th term as district attorney. His opponent was too new in politics to have any guile or malice in his attacks. Denise was wrong. That guileless Philip Rollins won an upset victory was more a repudiation of Denise than a vote of endorsement for an unknown aspirant for public office, the New Bedford Standard Times opined, having editorially supported Rollins. Denise didn't think Senator Kennedy had played a direct role in his defeat, but pro-Kennedy voters had perceived his handling of the Chappaquiddick case to be against the senator. Ethics prevented Denise from discussing the case after it was closed. "But I would not hesitate to handle the matter in the same way if I had a chance to do it all over again." Privately, Denise was bitter to have saved Ted Kennedy's career by preventing a grand jury from charging him with manslaughter at the expense of his own. He perceived a singular irony in the senator's re-election. "The girl died, and I got defeated." Preparing to take office in November, District Attorney Rollins ordered the transfer of all Chappaquiddick records from New Bedford to Barnstable Courthouse. Indictments clerk Lance Garth removed several state police photographs of the accident car as a souvenir of the case. Fernandez claimed proprietary rights to documents he had worked on during the exhumation and autopsy hearings. But the district attorney's office was not alone in suffering the displacement of records in the case. Edgartown police files vanished. The Registry of Motor Vehicles had lost Herb Burr's report on Senator Kennedy's license check, a diligent and thorough search failing to turn up the record. George Killen set about retrieving all the documents he could. On December 26, 1970, he requested return of exhibits submitted as evidence at the inquest by the district attorney's office from Dukes County Superior Court Clerk Sophie Campos. 3 days later, Mrs. Campos inquired of Chief Justice of the Superior Court, Walter McLaughlin, what the procedure was to return the requested items. What motives a young, unknown Republican district attorney might have in seeking to consolidate evidence in the Chappaquiddick case prompted a letter dated October 5, 1971, from Edward Hanafy. Citing our usual Massachusetts procedure, Hanafy asked that exhibits presented at the Kopechne inquest be returned to the parties who introduced them or to whom they respectively belong. The exhibits introduced by Kennedy attorneys at the inquest had been affidavits, a partial study of the physical factors of the accident, an engineer's report of his examination of Dyke Bridge and environs, and the medical records of Kennedy's physicians to the injuries he had suffered from the accident. According to Lieutenant Killen, the procedure Hanafy referred to applied to items of value, such as stolen property used as evidence in robbery and breaking and entering cases. There was nothing of value presented at the inquest that I knew about. The next day, Killen learned what Hanafy was after. Joseph Flanagan telephoned the district attorney's office from Wilkes Barre to inquire about the return to the parents of Mary Jo Kopechne of any exhibits introduced at the inquest, which belonged to her. The clothing she had worn on the night she was killed. Flanagan confirmed the conversation by letter, and was expecting to hear from the district attorney's office on Monday, October 11th. I couldn't figure out what the hell the Kopechnes wanted their daughter's clothes back for in the first place, Killen said later. In the second, whether the clothes belonged to Mary Jo Kopechne was debatable. The deceased owned no property rights to exhibits presented by the district attorney's office in a judicial hearing. Standard operating procedure was for evidence to be kept a minimum of 5 years in storage bins in the basement of the courthouse, longer in cases under appeal or subject to reinvestigation. To his amazement, Killen received an order dated October 31, 1971, from Superior Court Judge Walter McLaughlin, brother of Registrar Richard McLaughlin, for all exhibits introduced at the inquest to be returned to whom they respectively belong, or by whom they were respectively presented or introduced. Language virtually identical to Hanafy's inquiry. On November 3rd, Killen received all inquest exhibits, including exhibit number 5, consisting of one white, long-sleeve, button-front blouse or shirt, one pair color blue slacks, one bra, blue trim, one pair of leather sandals. 2 days later, Flanagan called the district attorney's office. Rather than receiving the clothes, the Kopechnes wanted them destroyed. Killen was loath to do it, but with a court order he had no choice. The district attorney was agreeable to having the clothing destroyed, Killen told Flanagan, but he wanted a letter to verify the request. Flanagan wrote to Killen on November 10, 1971, on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Kopechne, requesting the specific articles of clothing be destroyed, and for Killen to let him know when the district attorney's office had complied with the request. Killen made copies of all correspondence and memoranda for his personal files, to protect himself should it later be revealed he had participated in the destruction of evidence in a highly controversial case. On Tuesday, November 16, 1971, Killen went to the basement of Barnstable Courthouse accompanied by Bernie Flynn and a custodian. As Killen reported to Flanagan, the clothing and sandals were sprayed with lighter fluid prior to being thrown into the fire to ensure total burning. Chapter 55. The other elements of Chappaquiddick were not so easily disposed of as the clothes Mary Jo Kopechne had worn the night she died. One immediate consequence of Chappaquiddick was Kennedy's defeat in January 1971 as Senate Majority Whip. He admitted it hurt like hell to lose. What hurt even more was the collapse of his presidential prospects. But Ted Kennedy's preeminence as a potential Democratic candidate had been primarily a biological phenomenon, conservative columnist William F. Buckley Jr. wrote. What he now faces is a long struggle. His assets are his name, his talents, and his wealth. His liabilities are Chappaquiddick. If over the next 10 or more years Kennedy was able to show by his achievements a sobriety of purpose, a strategic manliness, and a sense of destiny and resolve, he could transcend the episode. Efforts to rehabilitate his political career were already underway. In the view of his political handlers, his presidential stature would rise as the memory of the accident faded. Kennedy had faced up to the humiliation of being called a coward and a liar after Chappaquiddick. The task was now to resurrect the mystique of a Kennedy dynasty. Said one advocate, In the minds of millions of Americans, he has no choice. The White House is his legacy, his ultimate responsibility, even his debt to society. Kennedy tried not to think about being president, he said. I don't discuss it with my family. We just don't talk about it. That business about promising my mother not to run, well, that's just not true. In November 1971, Kennedy toured 5 Midwestern states. His first avowedly political trip since his re-election in Massachusetts was inevitably looked upon as the commencement of the third Kennedy quest for the presidency of the United States. But even the most partisan of his supporters were uneasy in their assessment of Kennedy's temperament and character. Writing in the New York Times on April 10, 1972, historian James McGregor Burns observed, "In this context, Chappaquiddick is the issue that will not die." Nothing had been learned about the accident to challenge Kennedy's characterization of his behavior as anything but indefensible. Still, Burns wrote, Chappaquiddick had forced Kennedy to come to grips with himself, a self-confrontation which had brought iron into his soul. Burns insisted Kennedy had to be reckoned with as a potential presidential candidate in 1972. A genuine draft would mean that his post-Chappaquiddick period of probation was over, that the politicians considered him electable. It would be hard to respond to such a gesture with a refusal. To other observers, Kennedy was not far enough removed from the scandal to be a viable candidate. The notion of a draft rested upon the premise that enough voters had forgiven his misbehavior at Chappaquiddick. A pollster's test of voter attitudes, published by Harper's Magazine in July 1972, revealed the stigma not only persisted, it may be getting worse. 70% of those polled expressed the view Kennedy didn't tell the whole truth about what happened at Chappaquiddick. 60% said they trusted Richard Nixon more than Edward M. Kennedy. Nevertheless, political professionals were taking a hard look at Kennedy's chances. With a view to supporting a possible candidacy, Jack Conway, political lobbyist for the United Auto Workers, commissioned Joseph Walsh to make a study of the Chappaquiddick case. Walsh had left a position as public relations chief for the UAW in Detroit to form his own communications company. A tough, shrewd, former lobbyist for liberal causes, Walsh secured a copy of the inquest transcript, made numerous marginalia in questioning testimony, and submitted a confidential memorandum to Conway on November 18, 1971. Kennedy's biggest problem was, he is thought of as an indecisive weakling, a scoundrel or worse as a result of the accident. People believe he panicked under pressure, that he was out with an unmarried young woman for immoral purposes, and that when he had to face the facts, lied about his conduct, Walsh said. It is almost conventional wisdom that his explanation of what happened is not credible. While the facts strongly suggest something occurred altogether different from Kennedy's account, it is with this record as background he must run for president. Yet Richard Nixon was proof that public memory was short. His farewell tirade after his defeat for governor of California should have finished him off. But now he is president, Walsh said. The same could be true in Kennedy's case. Walsh suggested Kennedy pull out of the 1972 race, campaign extensively for whoever turned out to be the nominee, and duplicate Nixon's efforts in the 60s with hard, party regular work. Then, given well-publicized efforts in the Senate, make the run in 1976 or 1980 from the first primary to the last. Any other course would be disastrous for Kennedy's political career and the Democratic ticket in 1972. Kennedy conceded the potential for the education of Edward Kennedy to rescue his reputation from the residual swamp of Chappaquiddick, telling biographer Burton Hirsch, "My political fortunes are tied to your book." In an exhaustive examination of Kennedy's career, Hirsch dismissed Chappaquiddick as wholly a fluke and inevitable, absurd and tragic, overreported and misunderstood hours after it happened and now. To Hirsch, Kennedy said, "I really think I did all I could have, given the situation, my condition, all anybody else could have done." The handling of the case continued to rankle Jimmy Smith, complaining to Kennedy's Senate aide Paul Kirk that the persistence of memory about Chappaquiddick was largely self-inflicted. Smith got a call back from Kirk telling him, "The boss wants to see you." Smith went to Washington,